I have to confess to you, I've struggled to work out where I was going in planning and preparing this sermon today. Why is that? It's because every single weak and feeble mortal gets worn down, tired, weary, ceases to function, as we'd probably say, optimally. We get worn down to the point we can't think so clearly or creatively or productively. We can get down to the point where we lack commitment and follow through, to the point where, as one dear person said to me not so long ago, it becomes a struggle to get out of bed in the morning. Well, I'm glad to be out of bed, but the disastrous thing about getting into that sort of position is not that we lose our enjoyment, our enthusiasm, our zing. Those things are in many ways just simply lost pleasures, motivating pleasures, but still just losable and loss-making pleasures. The disastrous thing is that we defect from there to the path of least resistance. And Hebrews is a deep book which addresses just that problem. Let's look first of all then at what Hebrews is getting at. Now, I said Hebrews was a deep book, and I hope that word didn't simply pass you by. It's a deep book because it comes out of and addresses another culture. And when you drill down to the detail of the book, or get swamped by it, which is easy, it's a book written for people with a pre-knowledge, a deep pre-knowledge of the theology at the heart of their history. We don't have that. But it meant that they'd be acquainted with and skilled at handling long texts, and the convoluted arguments that they contained, and we're not necessarily there either. So for our modern Western minds, we need to break it down to the big points it's making, of which there are two, and then the ways it supports those two points, of which there are a number, each of them running to several chapters each. And that should give you an idea of why we're going to pick the points out and move at pace to the things Hebrews is trying to tell us about, not seeking the path of least resistance when we've been battered. First of all, then, it becomes important to work out what Hebrews is getting at by looking at the state of its audience in the first place. And we'll find a real window opened on that for us in Hebrews chapter 10, verses 32 to 34. The original audience for the reading of this book of Hebrews had quite clearly been battered. And it's written to them because not only they're battered, they're considering the path of least resistance. It's addressed to Hebrews, people of Jewish origin, descended from the 12 tribes of Israel, 10 of them now lost, of course, through the battering they'd taken, and the path of least resistance that battering had driven those 10 tribes into. But it's clear that this book isn't written to Jewish people still worshipping the old ways, but to Jewish people who've come to follow Jesus, yet who are feeling the pressure of following Jesus in a world that had crucified Christ and was now trying to do similar things to them, his followers, as well. So you get that in Hebrews 10, 32 to 34, which is worth looking at. It says this: remember those earlier days after you had received the light. Well, there you go. That tells us a lot about where they are. When you endured in a great conflict full of suffering. Oh. Sometimes you were publicly exposed to insult and persecution. At other times you stood side by side with those who were so treated. You suffered along with those in prison and joyfully accepted the confiscation of your property because, this is crucial to the point this book's making, because you knew that you yourselves had better and lasting possessions. Funny how that's put in the past tense there. Because you knew that you yourselves had better and lasting possessions. We'll see that that's relevant later. For now, it's clear that this pressure they were under, the weariness with their experience in a rebellious world, rebelling against God, this experience was tempting them to go back to the path of least resistance. So Hebrews 10:35 then continues. So do not throw away your confidence. It will be richly rewarded. You need to persevere so that when you've done the will of God, you will receive what he has promised. For in just a little while, it's a quote from the Old Testament, he who is coming will come and will not delay. And, another quote, but my righteous one will live by faith, and I take no pleasure in the one who shrinks back. But we, says Hebrews, do not belong to those who shrink back and are destroyed, but to those who have faith and are saved. Now in that context, that being the situation with these people, the book's goal is now twofold. What the book is going to do, the point that it's trying to achieve, is firstly, it wants to big up Jesus. Can I put it like that? So frequently, the troubles we meet in life and the wearing down of us in life too would be better met with a bigger view of Jesus. And by that bigger view of Jesus, I mean a bigger idea of who he is what he has done, what he can do, but also a zoomed-in view of him on the screen in our minds. Can I put it like that? So he is a bigger part of our picture of things. How great he is, but also zoomed in on him. So we get a better idea of the perspective from which a believer views life. Hebrews consistently aims at both those things. So, for example, constantly the first 10 chapters of Hebrews return to using the word better about Jesus or some aspect of what he's done. So Hebrews 7:19, for instance, says that in just one of the Lord's perfections that it's highlighted, says that a better hope is introduced by which we draw near to God. And that's just one example. Everywhere, Jesus is better. Better than the path of least resistance these world-weary pilgrims could so easily defect to. Firstly, the aim is to say Jesus is better. Secondly, the book's role is to challenge, to persevere with Jesus, whatever comes. So the book goes on from those first 10 chapters to lead into the second part of the book on persevering faithfully with Jesus, whatever the world made them weary with, however tempting the default non-options seem to be. Okay, first of all then, as we unpack this, the book of Hebrews demonstrates in chapters 1 to 10 the absolute superiority of Jesus. He is constantly better. Please notice that the author of this book is spelling out the superiority of Jesus over the comfortable old things they'd once held dear. Because discredited old comforts might look like comforts, but when they do, they are still simply discredited. And that's the very first thing that the book here sets about doing in quite a lot of chapters, 10 in fact. Discrediting the old comforts. Showing the superiority of Jesus, but starts by discrediting the old comforts. Hebrews takes time over that. A lot of chapters. Discrediting the old comforts they were toying with returning to, showing that Jesus is superior to the angels and the Torah, the Old Testament books of Moses, chapters 1 to 2 do that. Superior to Moses and the land, chapters 3 to 4. Superior to the Aaronic priesthood, you know, the Levites and all that, and Melchizedek, verses 5 to 7. And then superior to the sacrificial system up the temple and the Old Testament covenant, the Levitical covenant, chapters 8 to 10. It discredits, first of all, in showing the absolute superiority of Jesus, it discredits the old comforts, the things that people would lean on as old and familiar and comfortable, to show, then, Jesus is better, summing up his superiority to anything else. So chapters 1 to 2 assert that Jesus is better because he is God's word incarnate, whereas the Torah was not God with us. And then chapters 3 to 4 assert that Jesus is better because he brings hope for all creation, whereas Moses and the land did not offer any such thing. And then chapters 5 to 7 indicate that Jesus is better because he is a priest forever. And indeed, one greater than Melchizedek is here. So whereas human priests and people were morally flawed and needed to make regular, repeated atonement for their sin and for the people, Jesus is the ultimate priest and king, being morally flawless and eternal. A priest forever, bridging humanity and the divine. Chapters 5 to 7. And it followed from that, those chapters argue, that rejecting Jesus, God's perfect and eternal mediator and go-between with God, amounted to actually rejecting God. And there's a warning to avoid that that rings clear in this section. And then chapters 8 to 10 show how Jesus' sacrifice on the cross is better, there's that word again, than all the animal sacrifices offered at the temple. The temporal sacrifices had to be offered constantly, daily and annually in the appointed place. But Jesus sacrificed his life once forever on the cross. Done deal. Sufficient for the sins of the whole world. You know that old expression? My father tried to drum into me doing jobs around the place. Do it right. Do it once. Seems to me that applies here. And that's the sort of thing that chapters 8 to 10 of Hebrews are trying to show us. Jesus is better because he's done it right. So he's done it once. Jesus sacrificed his life once forever on the cross. Done deal, sufficient for the sins of the whole world. And then again, there's a warning sounded to avoid walking away from God's invitation to this all-sufficient atonement, which is, in point of fact, the new covenant spoken of for so long by the prophets, in which all sins are forgiven. Life is made rich. Well, there's a quick skirt through the first 10 chapters of the book of Hebrews. Given this superiority of Jesus, which those chapters establish, the second part of the book moves on to say that the reader should follow the example of the great heroes of the faith found throughout the scriptures and remain faithful to Jesus, because he's better. Trusting that whatever hardships this course of action brings, God will not abandon his people. But the two texts we've got for this sermon today don't start there. Our two texts are the first few verses of chapter 11 and the first few verses of chapter 12. We've coloured in the background to those now. But having established great hope for us in the multifaceted superiority of Jesus to any other distracting thing on offer in those previous chapters, up to the start of chapter 11, these verses we're looking at now go back to where Hebrews 11:1 actually finds world-weary people and starts to pick us up from there. First of all, then, where does Hebrew find us and help us? Chapter 11, verses 1 to 2. Where does Hebrews find us? World-weary and worn down. Therefore, potentially tempted to be looking for the path of least resistance through life. Well, these verses are going to first inspire us with the faith of the elders, because that faith addresses directly our world weariness and defecting to the path of least resistance. Check out this introductory and theme-setting paragraph, Hebrews 11, 1-2. Now, faith, it says, is confidence in what we hope for and assurance about what we do not see. This is what the ancients were commended for. Assurance about what we don't see. Confidence in what we hope for. And it starts off with faith. Well, faith, of course, this can have its origins in plain old tiredness, but when we submit to being worn down and world-weary, the issue that's at stake is in us is often faith-folding. We're believing in what's temporary but visible, rather than banking on the certainties that are unseen but eternal. So as of first importance, the book of Hebrews here then in chapter 11, verse 1, is taking us to that point. If faith fails, then world weariness and discipleship fatigue will rule the roost. So, because of that, Hebrews is about to walk us slowly around the gallery of the faithful to pause and soak up the beauty of their trusting walk with God. This is not a rationally based problem. This taking the path of least resistance. Not in fact. And our skillful pastor to the Hebrews is not addressing it as if it were a rationally based problem, but he's inspiring and moving the hearts and the motivation of the weary with the beauty of the example of the ones who've gone before. Faith. It's the confidence, the essence, he says. The word is hypostasis. Confidence, essence, a fascinating word with a wide range of nonetheless specific meanings, including something that settles, a sediment, a thick soup, and pus, would you believe? In this context, it doesn't mean any of those. It means confidence, an assured position, being sure. Now that's the bulwark against worn down world weariness, which is going to protect the soul, says Hebrews here. And then rolls out two phrases to unpack that before leading us quietly into the gallery where we can view what the ancients were commended for. Faith is firstly this word here, confidence. And that confidence is what goes first when faith fumbles. Because we've been ground down and grown weary in this world. Faith is the confidence or the assurance of the things Christians hope for. And that cuts the legs from under the ground downness that this world does to us. And it does so when our faith gets renewed. Faith deals with that ground downness. It gives confidence. It gives assurance. Our NIV translation gives us that word assurance. Let's look at that quickly, because again, that is an interesting way of putting something. I think these are words that Paul is using because you're going to have to make people think about it. You know, he's using these words saying, I'm going to have to go, hang on, what's he saying? And work it out. Assurance. The word they're translating this way is elenchos. It's a word that commonly means rebuke or reproof. Faith is the rebuke or reproof, a proof that by which a thing is proved or tested. And then by extension from that, a tested, tried and proven conviction. Hebrews are going next to show us how that faith becomes a tested, tried and proven conviction as we view the gallery of the tested, tried and proven historic faithful ones that the chapter goes on to walk us around, the gallery of faith. Got to be honest, I'm not a great fan of spiritual biographies. It's just a personal thing. But honest spiritual biographies can be powerfully helpful, especially when our faith and faithfulness has been worn down. I tend to go for the full-on heroics of the missionary history of Western Christianity, you know, like C.T. Studd by Norman Grubb, you know, C.T. always played a straight bat, that sort of thing. But wherever your personality takes you, the fellowship of God's people across the ages can be immensely helpful and inspiring. I haven't got the time to drag you through the gallery and the rest of this chapter here in chapter 11 of Hebrews, but their example stands out to prove that the remedy that Hebrews sets out for the world weariness that the reader has encountered. Now, faith is confidence in what we hope for and assurance about what we do not see. This is what the ancients were commended for. And then the author opens the gallery. Do go and read it, but we're pressing on past the gallery to get down to the stadium. Thirdly, where Hebrews is going and ultimately wants to take us. We've looked at where it found us and what it's got to say to us. Now we're looking at where it's going and ultimately where it wants to take us. In the next chapter, chapter 12, verses 1 to 2. In the face of these facts, and then this inspirational pattern of faithful examples that we skipped over, Hebrews wants to take us into a life of disciplined spiritual athleticism. The imagery used here, you see, suggests we're off to the games. What we need to do? Verse 1a, throw off. I got a new follower on Twitter recently, a farmer, an HGV driver who certainly appears to have an ironic sense of humour. No bad thing in many ways. He seems to have a lot of interaction with urban vegans and earth-friendly theorists who frustrate his agricultural approach to his environment. He runs a farm, gets fed up by people with no understanding of his world, telling him where he's going wrong. There may be a lesson there for teachers and preachers, actually, but we'll leave that aside for another day. Here's the point. At the top of your social media account, you have a profile. And in this, he lists his interests as including pretend pagan naked gardening. Now, something at once makes us realise he's being ironic because of what else we know about him. But the thought of even doing something as steady and unenergetic as gardening when unclothed is a place surely that our minds don't want to travel to. But here's the thing. There's the cultural problem. Because in the Greco-Roman world, athletes wouldn't have thought this was funny. See, they didn't slip their tracksuits off revealing shorts and vest. They dropped their togas to run, jump and throw things stark naked. And that's the idea that Hebrews is putting out here. The athlete at the track, in their world, dropped all the outward things that would encumber them to run, jump and throw things optimally with freedom of movement, guaranteeing optimal opportunity for best performance. And so in Hebrews 12:1, the author writes, therefore, since we're surrounded by such a cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles, and let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us. See, it is sin that gives the world around us the foothold to cling to us, makes us sticky to sin. And that is too great a burden to carry with all that stuff stuck to the outside of you. You're going to be wearing yourself out. Now, of course, our sins can feel very familiar and very comfortable. Our blankie, our comfort blanket to help us through life's hard experience. Yeah, you tend to find those things appeal in some way to your five senses. Visible, feelable things gaining access to beat you up from the inside out. You need to have thrown them off to deal with the world weariness and the shortcuts on offer to the path of least resistance, says Hebrews 12 and verse 1. Because once you've done that, once you've thrown them off, there's an opportunity to exercise that freedom you've just got for the next thing. Verse 1b, to run. Encouraged by the faithful example of those heroes in the gallery of faith and assured of the superiority of Jesus, he's better than anything else, then says Hebrews, having thrown everything off, let us throw everything off that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles, and let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us. But you say, I haven't the energy or the inclination to run. Running is exertion. Yeah, you're weighed down, aren't you? It requires determination, getting down to quite hard work. I had to lend a hand on Thursday, getting somebody's strayed cattle out the village. And trust me, it gets harder as you get older. Too weary to run? Well, the remedy for that is what's being set out before us here. When worn down, the key thing is renewing faith. The confidence in what we hope for and the assurance of what we do not see. You view the gallery of faith and then you drop the kit that's clung to you, the hindrances we've encountered and the sin that so easily entangles us, and then we run. But see, the thing is, when you've freed up your limbs and filled up your lungs and are now exerting yourself to run, there are two ways to run. You can run towards your goal or you can run seriously amok. Imagine one of those really brave, I think, blind Paralympians running their race with somebody attached to their wrist, calling out instructions to keep them in their lane as they run. Then think about what it would be like if suddenly in the middle of the race, all the assistant runners just slipped their lead. Those poor guys, those competitors, they'd either all stop running or run amok, wouldn't they? And the way to make sure you don't end up there in that situation, says Hebrews, is obvious. So here's the last thing. Throw off, run, then fix your eyes. We're assuming that we've got working eyes now. Hebrews 12:2-3, let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the pioneer and the perfecter of faith. For the joy that was set before him, he endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him who endured such opposition from sinners, so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. As the crowd goes quiet and you attempt the conversion kick, you follow through with your eyes to the place you want that ball to go, straight between the uprights above the bar. And as you take your swing at life and you're following by faith after Christ, you fix your eyes on the target you want to gain. You fix your eyes, says the Hebrews, on Christ. He's the author and perfecter of the faith we're going to need to protect us from the grind of our earthly existence and stop it producing the world weariness that makes us ultimately lose heart. Fix your eyes on him, who for the joy that it would lead to, endured the cross, scorning its shame, and having persevered now sits at the right hand of the Majesty in heaven. World-weary friends, tempted now by the path of least resistance. A path of least resistance is not worth it. Jesus is better. Throw off. Run. Fix your eyes. Here's the conclusion. For worn down, world weary, pressurized people, Hebrews, first of all, seeks to big up Jesus and challenge them, us, to persevere with Jesus whatever comes, because Jesus is so much better than any of the other easier looking options. And then it is faith, as supported by the encouragement found in the gallery of faith, that gives us the confidence and assurance to persevere with the things we can't see that are eternal, rather than bunking off to grasp what looks like the path of least resistance, but is both fundamentally temporary and ultimately passing away. And it is casting off the encumbrance of sin and running the race marked out for us, but doing so keeping our eyes fixed firmly on the author and the perfecter of our faith, which is the action required of us to persevere in running the race straight on to be with him in glory. God bless you. Put in a good run this week.